good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 579 of Unwelcome Guests, Financial Consolidation. I'm Robin Upton. Now, I'm not referring to hedge funds, the removal of Glass-Steagall and the subsequent consolidation of financial institutions and commercial banks. We're looking this week at a historical precursor. In our first hour, Edward Griffin continues speaking on the Rothschild formula, talking about why the financiers wanted America to get involved in World War I. Now, he continues by looking at the history of money and banking in the US, the First Bank of the United States, the connection between the Civil War and banking, up to the point at which the Federal Reserve Act is brought in by deceit in 1913. And in our second hour, we go further back still, looking at primordial concepts of money, debt, sin, and redemption. How did markets come about? Do they really need states to regulate them? Or is it states that need markets as a means of extracting taxes and exerting control? It's the usual philosophical stuff from David Graeber, worth re-listening, as I think it's full of connections to the present day and the coming global debt amnesty, which I think is the only solution to the so-called financial crisis. Now, let's carry on where we left off from two episodes ago. This is Edward Griffin's Reality Course on Money, speaking approximately a decade ago.
Well, what did these men want out of the Bolshevik Revolution? What does the cabal always want? If my thesis about the master plan is correct, it wanted three things. The overthrow of the Russian imperialist government, which would not borrow from a central bank, and the establishment of one that would. Two, the creation of a hostile, aggressive regime which would threaten Europe, and later the world, with war. Three, above all, it wanted the vast profits that could be extracted from the human and natural resources of Russia. I personally believe it obtained all of these objectives. And I think it continues to enjoy those objectives today, although some of them may be a little more hidden from view. I'd love to talk about that, but we don't have time. We have to move on. Let's move on now to World War I, a very interesting study. It was the sinking of the Lusitania that changed American public opinion from pacifism to acceptance of the necessity to enter World War I on the side of England against Germany. It is clear now, the records are so clear, that the ship was loaded to the gunwales with ammunition, and it was destined for England in violation of U.S. neutrality treaties. But what was more shocking is the fact that this fact was well known by our government, including President Wilson, and no one did anything either to stop it or to warn the innocent civilians who had booked passage on it. The German government had been sending notices of protest to the United States about the fact that not only this ship, but other ships were carrying munitions in violation of the treaty, and that this made them not passenger ships, but made them ships of war. As ships of war, the German government was saying they would become legitimate targets. We do not want to sink your passenger ships, but we have to because they are ships of war against us. The German government even ran advertisements in New York newspapers asking, pleading, warning Americans not to board those ships. Wilson knew it, many people in the government knew it, and as I said, did nothing either to stop the sailing of that ship and others or to warn the innocent civilians who had booked passage. Why? J.P. Morgan and Kuhn Loeb & Company had floated $1.5 billion in loans to England and France, on which they were having great difficulty collecting interest. how nice it would be if the American people could be required to make these payments for them. But that would necessitate getting the United States government to provide the money. Now, the U.S. ambassador to Britain at that time was Walter Hines Page, who, in addition to his ambassadorship, was under private contract and was receiving $25,000 a year for spending money from the National City Bank in New York. On March 5, 1917, Ambassador Page sent the following telegram to President Wilson, quote, "I think that the pressure of this approaching crisis has gone beyond the ability of the Morgan Financial Agency for the British and French governments. The greatest help we could give the Allies would be a government credit. Unless we go to war with Germany, however, our government, of course, cannot make such a direct grant of credit." End quote. You get the picture? You think bailing out of the banks is just something that's happening in the 1980s? No. Author George Viereck, in his book entitled The Strangest Friendship in History, Woodrow Wilson and Colonel House, that's the name of the book, it was published in 1932, revealed that 10 months before Wilson was reelected on his slogan that he kept us out of war, 10 months before that, his personal advisor, Colonel Edward Mandel House, had in fact negotiated a secret agreement with England and France on behalf of the president to intervene on their side, to get us into war. Now, during the war between 1915 and 1920, the U.S. supply of fiat money approximately doubled as a result of government debt to the central bank. The result, of course, was that the purchasing power of the dollar fell by about one half. That figures. You double the money supply, the purchasing power drops to one half. That means that during this period, the American people paid approximately half of the value of their entire money supply as tribute to the cabal, both in America and in Europe. And the way in which that was done is through a war. At the end of the war, the terms of the Versailles Treaty were extremely harsh against Germany. They created the kind of economic hardship and social unrest that always leads to the rise of a man on a white horse who promises drastic measures, including war, to cure those conditions and those ills. And Adolf Hitler became inevitable. There is little doubt, in my mind at least, that the men who negotiated these terms of the treaty knew fully well what they were doing and what the result was going to be. On the American side of the table, the man accompanying Wilson was his chief financial advisor, Paul Warburg. Warburg's brother, Max, was on the other side of the table representing Germany. It is an ugly fact of history, ladies and gentlemen, that American citizens were deliberately sacrificed by their leaders in order to get the United States into World War I, a war which would plunge the nation into debt, rescue a faltering England and France, and preserve the balance of power in Europe to guarantee additional wars in the years to come. Well, let me just cover World War II very briefly. There are many parallels. I'll just say this in summary. Pearl Harbor could have been averted. We had prior knowledge of the Japanese attack. That knowledge was bottled up in Washington at the highest level and withheld from our commanders at Pearl Harbor. Why? I submit the Rothschild formula. We had to get the United States back into war again. The American people would never accept a war unless they were attacked first. We set up trade restrictions, trade barriers so harsh against Japan that we knew the mentality of Japan would be that they had to strike us to save face. Not only that, we were strangling them economically. And you and I, if we're strangled, we will strike back. And a nation will do the same thing. The strangulation policy of our economic measures prior to the war made Japan inevitable as an aggressor against us. There's no question about that. We set it up. Now, as far as financing the war, it's clear that the financing for Nazi Germany came from the United States mostly, and some from England. Did not come from Germany. Remember, Germany was almost a bankrupt country. Did not have the economic resources. From the very beginning, the Nazis were financed by these sources outside of Germany, the same people we've been talking about. Most of the largest U.S. corporations, which were within the orbit of the cabal by ownership or control through bankers on the boards of directors of these corporations, heavily invested in war industries in Germany, not just in making sewer pipes and telephones, but making warplanes, tanks, guns. IG Farben was the largest of the German industrial cartels and was the primary source of funding for Hitler. The brain and power center behind the Nazi machine was IG Farben. Remember, these concentration camps at Bitterfeld and all the others were not run by the Nazis. They were not run by the military. This was the slave labor force for the factories. And who owned and ran the factories? IG Farben. Slave labor camps, the concentration camps, were not run by the Nazis, but by IG Farben. And yeah, they had a few soldiers with guns to keep the prisoners in line, but the operation was an industrial one. Farben even hired the New York public relations firm of Ivy Lee, who was John D. Rockefeller's PR specialist, to help improve Hitler's public image in America during his rise to power. Most of the capital for the formation and expansion of IG Farben came from Wall Street, primarily the National City Bank, Dillon Reed and Company, Harris Forbes and Company, Kuhn Loeb and Company, and the Equitable Trust Company, which was part of the Morgan Empire. Farben interests in the United States were centered in a holding company called American IG. On the board of directors of American IG were such prominent figures as C.E. Mitchell, chairman of the National City Bank and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Edsel Ford, president of the Ford Motor Company, Walter Teagle, president of Standard Oil of New Jersey, the Rockefeller Empire, and Paul Warburg, first director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and chairman of the Bank of Manhattan Company. It's an interesting fact that during the war, during those tremendous bombing operations where we leveled many cities right to the ground, did you realize that the factories and installations of IG Farben were untouched? I have seen photographs where there is rubble, absolute rubble, right up to a street, and then on the other side of the street there's nothing except grass and standing buildings, and that was IG Farben. I have talked to people who have lived in Germany during those raids, and they said when the sirens went off, they didn't go to the bomb shelters. They ran as fast as they could to sit on the lawn of IG Farben. It's a fact, because they knew those buildings would not be touched. And this was by design. Instructions came from Washington not to destroy those buildings. Why? I suggest that maybe there were people in the United States from financial banking circles who had an investment in those buildings. For example, the Secretary of War at that time was Robert P. Patterson. James Forrestal was Secretary of the Navy and later became the first Secretary of Defense. Now, both of these men had come from the Rockefeller investment firm of Dillon Reed and Company, and in fact, Forrestal had been president of Dillon Reed. And don't forget, Dillon Reed was one of the principal banking houses which raised the money and put together the IG Farben cartel. You begin to get the picture? Now, this same game was seen in the cabal's financing and building of heavy industry in communist countries since World War II. The Rockefeller Chase Manhattan Bank financed 45% of the Kama River truck plant in the Soviet Union. The trucks produced are used for military purposes and currently are seen on the streets of Afghanistan, as previously they had been seen on the streets in Vietnam. The Bank of America headed the syndicate that gave $25 million to communist Nicaragua at the end of 1982, at precisely the same time the American people were being taxed and price inflated to oppose Nicaragua's version of Central America. Okay, I think you get the picture. If you will use the Rothschild formula as a tentative template possible template and you lay it over the major wars of the last 200 years, pick any of them. Certainly both world wars, Korea, Vietnam, the revolutions in Russia, China, I skipped over that, but that certainly could be included. The first Bolshevik revolution in Mexico, did you know there was one? Mexico, by the way, was the first country to go to communism before Russia. Complete takeover. They lost it. They only held it for about a year, but they had it. In fact, the Soviet Constitution, the first draft of it, was in Mexico. The same people that wrote the Soviet Constitution had already done it as a trial in Mexico. Same people. In any event, lay this pattern, this template, over all of these wars, and you will see that certain facts emerge in all of them. And you'll see that some points always align. For instance, ask yourself, how many of the revolutions overthrew regimes which were unfriendly to the cabal and replaced them with those which were friendly? How many of the old governments were peaceful but replaced by hostile and aggressive regimes which have posed the threat of war or internal subversion against their neighbors? How many of the wars ended in neither decisive victory nor defeat for either side? And four, how many conflicts were aided on both sides by the same financial powers? Five, how much government debt was generated by both sides in the conflict? Six, how was the fiat money created to satisfy that debt? And seven, who benefited the most from any of this? And the bottom line is that last point. The only group that ever benefited from any of these wars is the financial elite about which we are speaking, the financial cabal. Is the Rothschild formula at work today? Well, consider the possibilities at least. In Europe, we have the threat of both conventional and nuclear war as a result of the Soviet Union, which was and is the creation of the cabal. It continues to be sustained by the cabal with the infusion of funding and technology. All of the verbiage and sound speeches and patriotic talk to the contrary, we still continue to send money and technology to the Soviet Union. So here we are keeping this credible military might as a potential enemy. How much debt has this led to? How much debt has the government incurred in both Europe and in the United States to oppose this military threat? In the Middle East and in Latin America, the threat of conventional war at least, and revolution as a result of aggressive Soviet satellites against their neighbors, how much of the military preparedness that is going into these potential combats results in debt, and how much debt to us and to other countries? Now, I'm not suggesting, this is very important, I want to make this clear, I'm not suggesting that the military threat of Nicaragua or Cuba or the Soviet Union is phony. It wouldn't work. The Rothschild formula will not work if it's a phony threat. It's got to be a real threat. There have to be real wars. Real people have to really die, and there has to be real blood flowing in the streets. So I'm not saying that you don't have to worry about these threats. I'm asking you to open your eyes a little larger and look at why we have these military threats and who is doing it to us. Once you get that larger picture, then and only then would you be able to come back down to earth and begin to think about what's going to happen in the economy and what we can do about it. But if you're still out there thinking that things are comic book, storybook reality instead of what they really are, you'll never be able to make the right decisions because you won't understand what really is going to happen. That is why I've gone through all of this. Do we have a time of peace today? Politicians are constantly telling us, oh, we mustn't do this, we mustn't do this. We don't want to bring on war. We don't want war. We want to preserve the peace. Ladies and gentlemen, since the end of World War II, it has been one of the greatest eras of war the world has ever known. Today, no continent except Antarctica is without war. There are from 25 to 40 military struggles going on somewhere in the world every day of the year. There have been more than 150 armed conflicts since the end of World War II, with the death count around 20 million human beings and rising. 20 million human beings have been killed in war since the end of World War II, and these men have the audacity to call this a time of peace. It is not surprising that this also is a period of constantly rising national debts and the creation of fiat money. I would like to conclude our morning session with this thought, that perhaps the greatest lesson of history is that debt creates war, and war creates debt. They are transmutable one into the other, and that is the heart of the Rothschild formula. I'd like to take a very quick look now at what the cabal has been up to in the United States. A good place to start is with the Constitution itself. Article 1, Section 8 says, Congress shall have the power to borrow money, coin money, regulate the value thereof, and to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting. Section 10 says, no state shall coin money, emit bills of credit, or make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. Now, emit bills of credit, in terms of the vocabulary that was used at the time of the writing of the Constitution, meant very clearly that they were forbidding fiat money, that is, any money that is not backed up by gold or silver. Now, why is that written into the Constitution? In a nutshell, the Founding Fathers had learned their lesson. Colonial America had gone through two devastating periods of monetary destruction. First, before the Revolutionary War, when the individual states themselves embarked on a rampage of creating fiat money. As a matter of fact, the first government outside of China, which had its own little thing going with papyrus earlier, papyrus being used as money, the first government in the so-called modern world that used paper money scientifically, so to speak, without backing of gold or silver, was the state of Massachusetts. All of the other colonies saw how profitable that was for Massachusetts, and they soon followed suit. The result was, in a nutshell, the middle class of the colonists was wiped out. People lost everything. They lost their farmland. They lost their personal possessions. And the speculators, the shrewd ones, are the ones that wound up with everything. And the little guy lost everything. And they had just learned their lesson, and then they wound up in the Revolutionary War. And once again, as we pointed out earlier, wars are very unpopular when they have to be paid out of taxes. And it is really questionable that the colonists would have supported the Revolutionary War if it had to be funded entirely out of direct taxes. I think it's safe to say that we would not be an independent nation today, at least not following the same path that we followed through the American Revolution, had it been funded out of taxes. So the young nation resorted to debt, and rather than borrowing from central banks, they started to print the money. The Continental was printed in great quantities. The statistics are in the syllabus for those of you who want to read them, but they're staggering, and it didn't take very long before that, too, had wiped out the middle class all over again. It was the next generation was wiped out. So by the time that it came to writing a constitution, the Founding Fathers, they remembered these experiences themselves, and there were enough people out there in the hinterlands who also remembered what fiat money really does. And they wanted no part of it, and they said that in plain English. This issue was thoroughly debated in the Constitutional Convention, and if you want to read any of those things, you will find that there was no doubt on the part of the great majority of the representatives that they wanted to prevent the new nation from having the power of creating fiat money. And they said so in about as clear language as you could possibly expect. In 1789, after this whole thing was resolved, the Constitution was in effect, and the nation was already embarked on a period of amazing prosperity. Prosperity the likes of which Europe had never seen, with all of its central banking. It absolutely amazed everyone, especially the Founding Fathers. And they said, boy, what a thing we have created. And they were feeling so good about it. And it was George Washington in 1789 who confirmed this good wisdom on their part when he said, quote, "We may one day become a great commercial and flourishing nation, but if in the pursuit of the means we should unfortunately stumble again on unfunded paper money or any similar species of fraud, we shall assuredly give a fatal stab to our national credit." What prophetic remarks those were. I would like to ask you to reread the Constitution, the sections that I quoted earlier. The constitutional prohibition against the issue of fiat money has never been repealed. It has never even been amended, nor has its directive that only gold and silver coin be accepted as legal tender. All of that remains in perfect tact, and yet it is totally ignored by the politicians and, I might add, by the general public. Why? Because they don't understand it. They do not understand the history of money. They don't even know what fiat money is. They think it's French currency of some kind. Fiat is a car, yes. An Italian car. Thank you, sir. They don't understand these things. So that is the basic problem. Every one of our elected representatives have sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution, and you might ask them the next time you communicate with them when they intend to
begin. Now I'd
like
to talk
about a couple of banks that were formed in the United States and disappeared. Many people are amazed to discover that we have had central banks in the United States in our history. And the fact is, we've had three of them. I'm going to have to move through this very quickly. But our first central bank was called the Bank of North America. Actually, this was established under the Articles of Confederation in 1782. It was led by Congressman Robert Morris, who was a very prominent banking figure at the time from Philadelphia. He was both a monetary scientist and a political scientist. He understood fully the advantages of the Mandrake mechanism and intended to take advantage of it in this country. He had been to Europe and studied it over there. He was a good student. He had contacts with the Rothschilds and other segments of the banking dynasties in Europe, and he became an extension of that philosophy here. Under his strong leadership and influence, they formed the Bank of North America, and it was chartered to do all of the things that central banks are chartered to do. It was modeled after the Bank of England. It was privately owned. It had a monopoly over the issue of money in this country. It was supported by government guarantee to accept that money for taxes as though it were valued the same as gold. No other banks were allowed to be formed in competition. It was allowed to expand the money supply by pyramiding on top of debt. It agreed to create money out of nothing for the government's use. And it promptly created $1,200,000 for the government to use immediately and to collect interest on it. Well, it was a short-lived experiment because the public was still familiar with the history of fiat money, and they were suspicious of banknotes, and they asked a lot of questions. Where's the gold? And it soon became obvious that there wasn't any gold, or at least not nearly enough to back it up, and the public stayed away in droves. Outside of Philadelphia, the banknotes were not very well accepted. Even in Philadelphia, they were generally discounted. And so it didn't take very long before the bank was in trouble, because if you can't inflate the money supply, if you can't create money out of nothing, and you can't do that if people aren't accepting it, then what's the point of having a central bank? Also, the political power of Robert Morris began to slip. Some of his shenanigans caught up with him. He no longer had his influence. And the first thing you know, just 1 year after the bank began, that was 1789, all of the government debt to the bank had been repaid. Now, can you imagine that? Within a year, the government had paid off its debt. That was a very bad start, I'm sorry to say. Glad our leaders have learned their lesson since. Anyway, they repaid the... I'm kidding, by the way, for the purpose of this recording. I don't want to be quoted. So without any money at loan or any fiat money, funny money, collecting interest, what is a bank to do? It goes out of business. And that is exactly what happened. The Bank of North America quietly converted to a commercial bank in Philadelphia. And just 1 year after it began, the first experiment in central banking in America ended in a failure for the bankers. It didn't take long, of course, before the group was back again. The problem is that the founding fathers, who drafted such a clear prohibition against fiat money being created by the government, we're not well enough informed to the complexity of monetary science to see the parallel to why a commercial bank shouldn't be allowed to create money out of nothing. Okay, they had learned that the government can't do it. That was clear. But now how about having a private bank and giving them the chance to have an elastic money supply to take care of the needs of commerce and business and agriculture? And, you know, if you really want to baffle people, you can use a tremendous amount of vocabulary to convince them that what you're talking about and proposing is a very good thing for the health, the economic health of the nation. These people are good at that, and I have a mental picture of some of these representatives who were, by this time, maybe not well-educated gentlemen, but representing rural communities who had a basic wisdom and some hard-learned knocks and that kind of thing, but not being able to quite see the picture about fractional reserve banking. What was that all about? You know, that sort of thing. Anyway, there was a limitation against creation of fiat money on the part of the government, but there was a loophole in the Constitution. There was nothing said about private banks doing this. So consequently, this is the loophole through which the international financiers crawled into the American fabric. And it was this ignorance that became a very important thing, not only then, but now. This factor of ignorance and not understanding was recognized by John Adams. He was one of the drafters of the Constitution, and he later became the second president of the United States. In a letter to Thomas Jefferson, it was Adams who said, quote, "All the perplexities, confusion, and distress in America arise not from the defects in their Constitution or Confederation, not from a want of honor or virtue, so much as from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation," end quote. And I can only say amen to that. That is basically our problem today. Well, the debate raged in Congress between the pro-banking forces who had strong financial ties to the European cabal. Remember, part of the formula, as Professor Quigley pointed out in the very beginning, was that these people have economic rewards in the business world for compliant politicians. So it is easy to see how pro-banking interests are always very dominant in the Congress and in the Senate. It is profitable to be pro-banking. So the debate raged. Jefferson was perhaps one of the strongest voices against the Mandrake mechanism. In fact, he led the opposition to this whole scheme in those early years, and it was Jefferson who said, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous than standing armies." Now, Hamilton, on the other hand, was pro-bank. He was a protege of Morris, had worked under Morris for some time, and Hamilton was one of those guys who was a believer in strong centralized government. As a matter of fact, Hamilton's idea was to create in the United States almost an exact copy of what they had in England, a mercantilist type of system with strong government, high taxes, protectionism, aggressive armies and navies, war all the time and conquering other lands and converting them into colonies to exploit on behalf of the business community. This was all part of a package that historians generally describe as mercantilism, and Hamilton was one of its advocates. It was Hamilton who said, "A national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing." See, it wasn't Keynes at all that came up with this first. It was Hamilton. And he also said this: "No society could succeed which did not unite the interest and credit of rich individuals with those of the state." Unfortunately, it was Hamilton's views which prevailed. In 1791, Congress granted a 20-year charter to what was called the First Bank of the United States. Okay, well, those words again, words that don't mean what to say. It wasn't the First Bank, it was the Second. And it wasn't of the United States, it was of the bankers. And it carried the name of the United States so that people would think it had somehow a connection with the government. It was a symbol of the continuity with the past. The man named as the president of the new bank was Thomas Willing, the longtime president of the older bank. So it was really the same group that somehow got back into power. Well, the result, as it always is, following the establishment of a central bank, was inflation. Creation of a lot of money out of nothing, flooding this money through the economy, money supply rising at a rate faster than goods and services, value of the money dropping, the appearance of rising prices, all of this. And the balance of power was finally tipped against the bank. The war over control of the nation's money raged throughout that 20-year period following. And by charter renewal time, because of this evidence of inflation and economic hardship, and don't forget, people are still close, relatively close in a time frame to the memory of the old ills of fiat money. Yes, the older folks are dying off and being replaced by the new ones who don't remember it, but still, there's a pretty good residue, a reservoir of memory there. So the bankers don't have that easy a time in that kind of an environment. So what actually happened was an amazing thing. By the end of charter renewal time, the balance of the power tipped away from the banks. Under the influence of Presidents Jefferson and Monroe, the government had paid off all of its debt again and was operating, if you can believe, out of current income. So, what is a bank to do? Jefferson set the mood of the day, and he also put his finger on the Rothschild formula when he said, quote, "It is incumbent on every generation to pay its own debts as it goes, a principle which, if acted on, would save one half of the wars of the world." End quote. And he also said, "What an obstruction could not this Bank of the United States, with all its branch banks, be in time of war? It might dictate to us the peace we should accept or withdraw its aids. Ought we then to give further growth to an institution so powerful, so hostile?" See, this is not new, ladies and gentlemen. Again, hurrying along, the charter lapsed in 1811. And, of course, there were strong political forces in Congress and in the Senate fighting this every bit of the way, but the public and the majority of the Congress and Senate were still opposed to it because they could see the wisdom of Jefferson and others who shared the same view. Then enters the Rothschild formula, the War of 1812. Many historians have struggled over the sensibility of the War of 1812. It doesn't make sense. When you really analyze it, there was no excuse for that war, unless you lay the Rothschild formula down as a template over the historical events, and all of a sudden, everything lines up. Everything lines up. In the United States, all the wildcat banks were agitating on behalf of the war. Why? Because they were going to lend money to the United States, money which they created out of nothing, and they could collect interest on it because you need money to fight a war. It was a profitable thing to do. So I'm trying to skip ahead here. I'm doing that with confidence because for those of you who want details, there's a lot more of it here in the syllabus. I'll just say that as a result of getting into this war and these wildcat banks, that was the name given to the banks generally that were in the South and Midwest. These were the small banks that were springing up. You see, you could go into the banking business with very little capital. You just get yourself and a couple of friends together and you're a bank. The regulations and requirements were very small. They used to get these kegs of nails and set them out there in the showroom and then cover the top with gold coins. And people come and look and say, boy, they got a lot of gold in reserve here. And sort of the same trick they do when Chase Manhattan Bank issues its financial statement, you know. All those billions of dollars in assets, which are not assets at all, they're liabilities. But anyway, these wildcat banks were springing up and they wanted to be able to lend to the government. So it's historically a fact that the great pressure for the War of 1812 came from those banks. And when those banks did lend money to the government, there was the inflation, there were runs on the bank, the banks couldn't pay, and the government came to the rescue. You see, the partnership was already forming. Government came to the rescue and allowed the banks to suspend payment in specie, protected them from honoring their contractual obligations. There was a great deal of chaos that resulted from that, and there was what I call the duck dinner of 1819. The cabal began to employ that mechanism of pushing the saw and then pulling it and pushing it up and down on the money supply Even though it was not well centralized under one central bank, the smaller banks were doing this sort of by mutual agreement. But you must recognize when it's not centralized, there is some competition between these individual banks. And if any one of them gets too far out of line, or at least inflates at a rate greater than the others, then the others call in their notes and the offending party goes bankrupt. So by having a little competition among all these fraudulent banks, the degree of fraud is somewhat limited. You know, competition between thieves sort of limits thievery a little bit. Much more than if they all got together. That's the only point. Now, Andrew Jackson, was elected in 1828, largely on a platform of opposition to fiat money and opposition to the concept of a central bank. He correctly blamed fiat money as the cause of the nation's disastrous booms and busts. And when the charter for the Second Bank of the United States was renewed for another 20 years by Congress, by a narrow vote, Jackson vetoed it. Now that took guts. Congress renewed the charter. Jackson vetoed it. His opinion was that the American people did not want a central bank. Only the politicians who were at the gravy train or on the gravy train really wanted it. And he was right. He put his political career right on the line, and he campaigned for re-election on the slogan, "Bank and no Jackson," or "No bank and Jackson." You imagine a politician today doing that? It reminds me of the joke about when Jimmy Carter was president. Let's see if I can get this right now. It just popped into my mind. They were talking about Jimmy Carter as a boy, a young boy on the, you know, on the peanut farm. And his father went to him and he said, "Jimmy, did you cut down the peanut vine?" He said, "Father, I cannot tell a lie. Maybe I did and maybe I didn't." Jackson was not that kind of a person. He said, "Bank and no Jackson," or "No bank and Jackson." Now, although the Second Bank of the United States had all the earmarks of a totally American operation, it was, in fact, it was known at that time that the principal investor and power behind the scenes was Baron James de Rothschild of Paris. In Jackson's message at the time of the veto, Jackson revealed that only a relatively few people owned stock in the bank, that these were from the very richest class of society, and that $8 million worth of those shares actually were owned not by Americans, but by foreigners. He said, quote, "Is there no danger to our liberty and independence in a bank that in its nature has so little to bind it to our country? Is there not cause to tremble for the purity of our elections in peace and for the independence of our country in war?" Well, anyway, Jackson won by a handsome margin, and in the election of 1832, it was clear that he was correct in his appraisal of popular support. It was only the politicians who wanted it, not the people. And he sent a message very clear to the bank. He started to withdraw the government funds from the Second Bank of the United States as a move to phase out the bank prior to its expiration, which was coming up soon. Then an interesting thing happened to reveal the power of the bank. The head of the bank was Nicholas Biddle, and he swiftly counterattacked. His plan was to disrupt the economy and to create conditions that were so bad in the business community and in the agricultural community and everybody's pocketbook that there would be an outcry for reform and that people would object to what Jackson had done. They would say, "Look, you see what happened? You're phasing out the bank, and now look what's happening to the economy." So they deliberately began to flood the economy with money and then pull it out in great, great amounts. The swings up and down were absolutely fantastic. And Biddle made no bones about what he was doing. He said, quote, "Nothing but the evidence of suffering will produce any effect in Congress. My own course is decided. All other banks and all the merchants may break, but the Bank of the United States shall not break." End quote. Jackson replied, "The bold effort the present bank had made to control the government, the distress it had wantonly produced, are but premonitions of the fate that awaits the American people should they be deluded into a perpetuation of this institution or the establishment of another like it. And then speaking directly to the cabal, he said, "You are a den of vipers. I intend to rout you out, and by the eternal God, I will rout you out. If the people only understood the rank injustice of their money and banking system, there would be a revolution before morning." End quote. And he was right. That is more true today than ever. On January 30, 1835, there was an assassination attempt against Andrew Jackson. Surprise? Miraculously, both pistols misfired. It was the first such attempt against the life of a president of the United States. The would-be assassin was Richard Lawrence, who was either truly insane or who put on the act of insanity to escape harsh punishment. No one is really quite sure. At any rate, Lawrence was found not guilty due to insanity. Later, he boasted that he had been in touch with powerful people in Europe who had promised to protect him from punishment should he be caught. Well, the charter expired. Jackson survived, but the bank did not. In 1836, true to his campaign promise, the United States had Jackson and no bank. Now we swing to the Civil War. And I am in trouble on time. Serious trouble. I'll have to summarize this whole section on the Civil War by simply telling you that the Rothschild formula fits over it extremely well. There were secret societies at work, primarily the Knights of the Golden Circle, which was clear financed from Europe, primarily by the Rothschilds, and the whole plan of the Civil War, which was actually plotted and planned in England, at a meeting in England, was to split the United States for a balance of power to prevent the United States from continuing to grow in strength and prosperity so that it could dominate the continent. The European powers already were making inroads into Latin America, and this is one of the reasons for the Monroe Doctrine, which was to say, hey, you bankers over there, if you continue to move into Latin America, we will consider it as a move against us. That was like a declaration of war against the cabal. The cabal had to break the power of the United States. They had an excellent issue in the issue of slavery, but it was largely manufactured insofar as bringing on the war. The Knights of the Golden Circle and other groups were sent in among the American people, particularly in the South, to inflame the emotional level of resistance in the North, to make the issue of emancipation an emotional issue, and all this sort of thing. It's all in the syllabus. It's extremely interesting reading, but it's interesting to note also what Lincoln had to say about it. You think his interest was primarily in freeing the slaves? No. He said, "My paramount objective in this struggle is to save the Union. If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do so." The issue here was the Union, preserving the Union against those who would break apart the Union. The plan was to break the South apart and join it with Mexico and create a balance of power. And you'll find some interesting names in there. Jesse James was a very important part of that. Jesse James was not a common crook. He did not rob trains and stagecoaches for personal gain. He already was worth over $5 million by the time he was only 23. He was a very wealthy man. He was the head of the Knights of the Golden Circle. And they were committing these robberies, much as terrorists do today, to raise money for the revolution, to raise money for the Knights of the Golden Circle, to create the funding for a successful civil war on the part of the South and Mexico. I have to skip over all of that. The point is that Lincoln resisted it. Now, I have some pros and cons about Lincoln. He violated the Constitution. He created fiat money. He went directly against the Constitution, but at least he didn't do it in partnership with the bankers. He created money out of nothing, which was illegal, but at least he didn't tax the American people to pay interest on it. And you have to give him some credit for that, which made him very unpopular. He did not play the game correctly. By the way, I have to add that Tsar Alexander II of Russia came to the side of the North and sent ships to Lincoln's assistance, which helped blockade all of the ships that were coming from England and France on behalf of the South. And it was largely the military intervention of Tsar Nicholas II that helped preserve the Union of the United States, a little-known fact of history. Well, anyway, the result is clear. The Union was preserved. Lincoln was assassinated on April 14, 1865 by John Wilkes Booth, a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle. Tsar Alexander was assassinated a few years later by members of a similar group in Russia called the People's Will, a part of the nihilist movement which was financed from New York by Kuhn, Loeb & Company. In 1875, there was a Specie Redemption Act, and the final act of the tragedy was played out when, by law, all of those greenbacks which were printed under Lincoln were finally redeemed at face value in gold, and the national honor was restored. Once again, the bank had been beaten, and it was time for a new strategy. So what was this new strategy? There were 7 points. First, don't call it a bank. Second, make it look like a government operation. Three, make it appear decentralized geographically, not dominated by Wall Street or the New York banks. Four, begin with a conservative structure with many safeguards, knowing that after it's established, the safeguards can be removed one by one over a period of time. Five, cause economic disruptions to create a popular acceptance and a demand for the need for reform. Six, offer the new plan as an answer to that need. Seven, convince the public that the big bankers don't want it. Now, the plan was devised at a secret meeting held on Jekyll Island in Georgia in November of 1910 at the private Hunt Club of J.P. Morgan. The meeting was organized by Senator Nelson W. Aldrich. Now, Aldrich's daughter, Abby, was married to John D. Rockefeller, Jr., who had purchased the Chase Bank. Aldrich also was a business associate of J.P. Morgan. So that gives you a pretty good idea of his background. Now, after the panic of 1907, which was largely manipulated by Morgan, Congress established the National Monetary Commission to study the problem and to propose remedial legislation. And guess who became the head of that commission? Nelson Aldrich. Aldrich spent 2 years in Europe. He spent over $300,000 of taxpayers' money and was wined and dined by the European bankers, especially those with extensive banking interests in the United States. When he returned to the United States, he consulted with J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller and set up the secret meeting on Jekyll Island to hammer out the final plan, which was to be submitted to Congress supposedly as the findings and recommendations of the National Monetary Commission. Now, it was paramount to this group that their presence at this meeting, or for that matter, the very existence of the meeting itself, be kept secret from the business world and from the public. Other members of the club were excluded for 9 days. They were simply told that the club was going to be used for private purposes. The regular servants were replaced. The participants were instructed to avoid reporters and to use first names only. They traveled from the Hoboken Railway Station in New Jersey aboard Senator Aldrich's private railway car. The shades were drawn, and the special car departed with an unannounced destination. Now, who were those men that traveled with Aldrich to Jekyll Island? There were 6 of them. In addition to Aldrich, there was A. Piatt Andrew, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. Frank Vanderlip, President of the National City Bank of New York, the most powerful bank at that time, representing William Rockefeller and Kuhn Loeb & Company. Henry P. Davison, senior partner of the J.P. Morgan Company. There was Charles D. Norton, president of Morgan's First National Bank of New York. There was Benjamin Strong, head of Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And finally, there was Paul Warburg, brother of Max Warburg in Germany, a liaison to the House of Rothschild and a partner of Kuhn Loeb & Company. Now, the secret of this meeting was kept for several decades. Even now, it's interesting that there are many establishment historians who claim that the meeting never took place. But the truth was finally revealed 20 years later by both Warburg and Vanderlip, two people who attended the meeting. In 1930, Paul Warburg wrote a book entitled The Federal Reserve System, Its Origin and Growth. In this book, he described the meeting, but he made no mention of its location. In that same year, Warburg wrote a brief statement to appear in the official biography of Nelson Aldridge. The biography was written by Professor Nathan Stevenson, and on page 485, it was Warburg who said, quote, "The matter of a uniform discount rate was discussed and settled at Jekyll Island," end quote. And so there, in this second book, Warburg actually named the location of that meeting. Warburg's son, James, wrote a book in 1964 entitled The Long Road Home. In it, he said that his father, who didn't know one end of a gun from another, borrowed a shotgun to carry with him to the train station in order to disguise himself as a mere duck hunter. Now, in the February 9, 1935 issue of the Saturday Evening Post, an article appeared written by Frank Vanderlip. And in it, this is what Vanderlip said. Quote, "Despite my views about the value to society of greater publicity for the affairs of corporations, there was an occasion near the close of 1910 when I was as secretive, indeed as furtive, as any conspirator. I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. We were told to leave our last names behind us. We were told further that we should avoid dining together on the night of our departure. We were instructed to come one at a time and as unobtrusively as possible to the railroad terminal on the New Jersey littoral of the Hudson, where Senator Aldridge's private car would be in readiness. Once aboard the private car, we began to observe the taboo that had been fixed on last names. We addressed one another as Ben, Paul, Nelson, Abe. Davison and I adopted even deeper disguises, abandoning our own first names. On the theory that we were always right, he became Wilbur and I became Orville after those two aviation pioneers, the Wright brothers." Now, the servants and train crew may have known the identities of one or two of us, but they did not know all. And it was the names of all printed together that would have made our mysterious journey significant in Washington, in Wall Street, even in London. Discovery, we knew, simply must not happen, or else all our time and effort would be wasted. End quote. The principal architect of the Federal Reserve System and the man who dominated that meeting on Jekyll Island was Paul Warburg. His brother Max, as you recall, who stayed in Germany, was one of the principal financial forces behind the Bolshevik Revolution. His other brother, Felix, married Frieda Schiff, daughter of Jacob Schiff. Now, Jacob Schiff was the other primary source of funding for communism in Russia. Paul Warburg married Nina Loeb, daughter of Solomon Loeb of Kuhn Loeb & Company. Both Paul and Felix became partners in Kuhn Loeb & Company, which in turn was substantially financed by Warburg's European partners, the Rothschilds. The second daughter of Solomon Loeb married Isaac Seligman of Seligman & Company of New York, and by so doing, that family was brought into the circle. Political and financial marriages were studied and arranged more carefully than those of kings to concentrate political and financial power. Thus, by merger and marriage, the most powerful banking institutions in the world, the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, the Schiffs, the Loebs, the Seligmans, the Morgans, and the Rockefellers, all joined forces in utmost secrecy to create the Federal Reserve System. And if that is not an invisible cabal, then those words have no dictionary meaning at all.